Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has two matters on its oral submission docket. They are M. Ray E. I. DuPont, E. Morris & Company, on original mandamus petition, and Mark Andrew Telstorcer versus Ali V. Tonnell from Brazos County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The later or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. We'll take a brief recess in between each argument. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk for the convenience of the court. You may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee by making application with the clerk. We are ready to hear argument from the lector in DuPont.
May it please the court, Mr. Greg Smith will present argument for the relator. Relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court and good morning. In the history of American jurisprudence, no litigation has consumed more litigant time, involved more parties, or monopolized more judicial resources than asbestos litigation. And that is true especially of this state, Your Honors, which until very recently was recognized by the United States Supreme Court as having constituted itself the world's forum of last resort in asbestos litigation. In 1997, though, the Texas legislature, knowing that, addressed the issue and passed a statute, the statute that will be the basis primarily of our discussions today. That is section 71.052 of the Texas Civil Practices and Remedies Code. In our discussions about the statute and about its applications to DuPont, I would hope that we would touch on three issues. First of all, does the statute mandate dismissal of the claims against DuPont? Secondly, are post-trial appeals adequate to address the statute's dismissal right? And then finally, have the plaintiffs somehow proved any affirmative impediment other than the two traditional mandamus prongs to the grant of mandamus in this case? I would suggest that the answer to the first question is yes, section 71.052 does indeed mandate dismissal of the claims against DuPont, quite simply because the statute, in its plain terms, states four requirements, and when those four requirements are met, those being that the claim involves asbestos exposure, that the claim involves it arose out of state, that it arose to a plaintiff who resided out of state when the claim arose, and then finally that it arose within the proper window of time. If those four requisites are met, dismissal is mandated. There is no trial court discretion in the statute. So recognize this is not the general permissive forum non-convenience statute that we discussed today. It is a mandatory statute.
Is the burden upon the defendant to show that all requirements have been met under the statute before being entitled to dismissal?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it would be as far as those four elements.
Well, aren't there some plaintiffs that are included in this group that may not have been Texas residents at the, that were Texas residents at the time the claim arose?
Your Honor, there are, as we calculated, 34 claimants out of more than 8,000 who at some time in their working life were Texas residents. The first observation, Your Honor, is as to all but those 34, clearly, indisputably, I don't think there is a dispute in this case that the four elements of the statute were met.
But as to those 34, yes,
Your Honor, and I apologize for not getting straight away to the question. As to those 34, several responses. First of all, the statute itself provides a mechanism for determining where and when the claim arose. In its final subpart, subpart H, it states that when a defendant's exposure is in more than one state, that you look to the predominant exposure.
Well, my point in asking the question is this. If it is the burden of the defendant to show that all requirements have met, is there any dispute as to all 8,000 plaintiffs that you claim should have their claims dismissed against DuPont with respect to the proof of those elements?
Your Honor, the plaintiffs have not raised a dispute with respect to the proof of those,
elements. I understand from the briefing that there are allegations that there are, as you said, something like 34 plaintiffs for whom DuPont has not met the requirement to show that all of these things are met. And I'm just trying to ascertain if you prevail or not. Do you prevail entirely, or is there a dispute as to any of these plaintiffs as to whether or not their claims should be dismissed because there's some question about whether they were Texas residents or not?
First of all, Your Honor, as to the 8,000 or so plaintiffs who never, ever lived in Texas, their claims or the dismissal right as to those is not held hostage by the other 34.
Okay,
and then secondly, as to the other 34, DuPont believes that the record establishes the factors that would mandate, even given that they had some brief Texas residents, that would mandate that the trial court determine that the claims overall arose out of state.
Well, have we ever had a determination by the trial court on that issue?
No, Your Honor, we have not had.
So wouldn't it be appropriate for the trial court, even if we rule in your favor with respect to interpreting the statute, to determine which of these 8,000 claims would be subject to dismissal?
Your Honor, I believe the answer to that is that at the time that the hearing concluded, the trial court made its decision, closed the record, closed the evidence, there was no controverting evidence, there was no controversy.
But that's why my first question to you wasn't it incumbent upon DuPont in the first instance to prove the requirements of the statute?
Your Honor, DuPont, we believe, made a prima facie showing of every one of those requirements, even as to the 34.
Even as to the 34. So you don't think that there are any Texas residents who are included in your group?
No, Your Honor, I do not think so. Your Honors, as to the availability of mandamus, the adequacy of the appeal right or not, the important issues here are that this, the most important of all, is that the statute itself, its purpose, is a docket-clearing mechanism, and that that purpose cannot be served at all if this court allows the trial court's refusal to dismiss to percolate through the system until a final appeal. And even that, though, Your Honor, we're held hostage to the fact that this issue as to DuPont, if it's not decided today, if it's not decided through mandamus, may well evade review. You find that in this case, the plaintiffs have thus far refused to take DuPont to a trial. Several trial groups, small trial groups, have occurred, but DuPont has been non-suited, or severed at least, from every one of those trial groups. So as yet, DuPont has not been brought to trial, but yet DuPont has been forced to suffer all the burdens of pretrial discovery.
Mr. Smith, one of your arguments related to why there's no adequate remedy on appeal is that you take the position that Section 71.052 is a subject matter jurisdiction provision as opposed to any triggering any other type of issue. And on that basis say that because the trial court acted outside its jurisdiction, it should be mandamused. On what do you hang your argument that this is a subject matter jurisdiction provision besides the reference to jurisdiction solely in the title to that section?
Your Honor, primarily as far as the statutory language, it would be the reference to jurisdiction, but secondarily it would also be the absolute dismissal right that is conferred. We view the statute as being one that states that if these four elements are met, the trial court has no ability, no authority to do anything but dismiss in this case, such that the trial court's power is constricted. Now that power.
Well, but the court has other power though if the plaintiff chooses under subpart C to take certain action in order to try to preserve its claim from dismissal. How could the trial court act on, for example, the election to abate if it didn't have subject matter jurisdiction?
Your Honor, as we understand the statute, the election to debate, to abate must occur before the trial court's ruling on the dismissal motion. That comes first. Then, if the election occurs and it's an election to abate or an election to accept the Texas punitive damage cap, then indeed jurisdiction exists in the case.
I'm sorry, say that again?
If the plaintiff makes that election, and that's the problem here, the plaintiffs refuse to make the election.
If the plaintiff makes the election, then the court obtains subject matter jurisdiction
at
that point?
The court's jurisdiction continues. The limitation never rises up.
Then this is not a subject matter jurisdiction statute.
Your Honor, I will confess that subject matter may not be the precise word here. The point is primarily to distinguish that, I think, from a personal jurisdiction statute. And clearly, this is not a personal jurisdiction.
So you're not hanging on your hat on the fact that this is a subject matter jurisdiction statute?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe we have to go that far. All we have to do as a relator is show that the statute circumscribes the trial court's discretion, and it certainly does that. And that discretion was circumscribed in this particular case because DuPont proved all four elements. DuPont made the stipulations about use of discovery product and about statute of limitations that this statute imposes on it. And then the plaintiffs were then placed to their election. Did they want to abate this case, or did they want to accept the punitive damage caps that continue on in Texas? And the plaintiffs indeed chose to do neither. They refused that election. The statute is clear that in that circumstance, if the plaintiffs don't make that election, there is one choice, and one choice only. That is that the trial court shall dismiss. The trial court in this case refused to dismiss. That is the clear violation of law that DuPont raises in this case. And I believe it's a violation that cannot actually be contested in this case. The question then is, again, is mandamus available? If
can
mandamus...
You up, can you forfeit your right to any relief due to laches or waiver or some failure to act? And if so, how come waiting nearly 3 years to bring this motion to constitute that type of behavior?
Your Honor, I find it difficult to agree that DuPont could waive, well, that laches could apply in this case when this legislature chose, it understood that it could place a time limit on the motion practice, and it chose not to do so. Placed a time limit on the permissive form nonconvenience statute, but it didn't here. Now, as for waiver arguments go, I would suggest that those arguments, first of all, were waived in the trial court, when the plaintiffs themselves never brought forth any waiver argument. They weren't proven in the trial court, certainly. Waiver argument or forfeiture argument to apply here, the plaintiffs would have to prove that DuPont induced reliance and that DuPont acted inconsistent with its rights under the statute. There is no such proof in this record, no such allegation. So for those reasons...
River City, hasn't this court made a determination that we look at the record and the mandamus, and if we look and decide that they haven't filed timely 3 months, that's just too late, it's not the emergency that they're claiming it is?
Well, Your Honor, this statute doesn't mean that it has to be an emergency. Recognize that this statute, the window that the legislature...
But this is not a standard for the statute. This is a mandamus.
Or mandamus.
So the statute, I mean, the argument goes, can this be protected on appeal or not? That's when we exercise our jurisdiction to take a mandamus. And you argue all that the statute's met, so now the dismissal ought to be there. And the question is, should we enter the fray in mandamus? And River City would say, well, gosh, if you waited 3 years to argue this, maybe this isn't as important to you as you're trying to make us think it is. And so why should we now impose mandamus? That's the point.
I see two questions at play here. Number one is, did we wait too long to exercise our statutory motion right? And then number two, after that, or after the trial court's ruling, did DuPont wait too long to file a mandamus petition? I will address those in turn. First of all, as to the statutory motion right, recognize that the legislature, when it passed this statute, applied the motion right to cases that had been in existence for almost 2 full years at the time the statute was passed. So the legislature recognized in its policymaking power that it would apply this docket clearing function even to claims that had existed 2 years or about in the judicial system, even if they were absolutely raised at the first instance. So the legislature saw fit that there wasn't that kind of immediacy. That's the first half of the first answer. The second half is that there is an explanation for why DuPont, in this case, didn't immediately raise the motion, and that is that it had special appearance litigation percolating, and certainly DuPont didn't want to act inconsistent with its position in special appearance in the special appearance proceedings. And as soon as those were concluded, DuPont timely filed this motion, I would believe, Your Honor, and had it heard.
There's no legal impediment. You just thought that would look bad from an appellate strategy.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I do think that's correct. And secondly, as to the mandamus right, there really isn't any delay as to when DuPont filed the mandamus. Now, it's true that this proceeding percolates from two different district courts, and the dismissal motion was ruled on in one court about 3 months earlier than it was ruled on in the second court. DuPont did delay filing mandamus in the first proceeding in an attempt to line the two up. There's no allegation in this case, no suggestion that I know of, whether it be on the record or behind the record, that in those intervening times that somehow the plaintiffs were prejudiced by DuPont's decision about
what if anything was going on in the trial court while your special appearance was pending in the appellate?
Well, in the trial court, certainly discovery was going on as to the predominant bulk, the other 70 or so defendants at the time, which now have been whittled down to about 20. By and large, the discovery as to DuPont was somewhat limited, and then there was certainly no trial as to DuPont because the claims against DuPont, were either severed or non-suited.
Mr. Smith, looking at the statutory interpretation question, I understand that you place your emphasis on the reference to claim in Part A of Section 71.052. How do you reconcile that with the statutory note, which says that, that Section 2, which is, was the bill, applies to a civil action that is pending on the effective date of the Act? And the reference, the legislative reference, is to the application of the statute to a pending civil action as opposed to a claim.
Right. I see there being an overlay there, Your Honor. First of all, the enabling legislation or the reference states that the statute's purpose is to take care of cases that were already in the system. And then secondly, when this legislature addressed the problem through the very statutory language, the legislature chose to address it on a claim-by-claim basis. So I don't see an inconsistency there, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Bill Dorsanio will present argument for the real parties in interest.
May it please the court, the real parties in interest believe that mandamusing dismissal of the plaintiff's claim would actually subvert the statutory scheme as it was revised in 1997. In connection with that central argument, the real parties in interest take the position and contend that the trial judges committed no abuse of discretion, not a clear abuse of discretion, not a super clear abuse of discretion, or any kind of abuse of discretion under the circumstances of the case, which involved DuPont waiting more than 2 years in one case and approximately 3 years in the other case to file the motion to dismiss on the basis of 71052.
Have you claimed any prejudice that you've experienced as a result of that delay?
Yes, Your Honor. The prejudice that we experienced with respect to the delay is the prejudice of participating in litigation in the trial court. Actually, there was considerable discovery and arguments about the sufficiency of the pleadings with respect to the plaintiffs and DuPont. DuPont affirmatively sought discovery, merits discovery, and sought to challenge the plaintiff's pleadings on the basis of special exceptions, and there were hearings conducted. There was considerable litigation during the interim period when no motion for nonconvenience was dismissed.
Have you changed your position in any way as a result of...
Well, one of the things that was not done by the plaintiffs is they didn't seek to go to an alternative forum or to check to see if one was available, which is something that the statute contemplates that plaintiffs might do. And it's something that may have been more possible in the past than now. But litigating in the trial court particular issues...
But we don't have anything in the record specifically to that effect. I mean, that's a vague notion we have, but you don't have any particular plaintiffs here who you can show failed to make an election and therefore could have brought their suit somewhere else if this had been done earlier by DuPont.
No, Your Honor. The trial judges denied motions to dismiss.
But there's nothing before the trial court, nothing in the record we could hang our hat on in terms of some sort of tangible prejudice or right that was given up in another forum.
At the one hearing that was conducted with respect to an oral presentation before Judge Clark, only one of these cases, as I understand it, actually had a hearing, the Parsons case. At that one hearing, there was a lot of discussion about discovery issues and special exception issues. It's perfectly clear that the trial judge regarded the behavior of DuPont in that context as dilatory.
That's not the focus of my question. The focus is, I can see a very compelling argument that if the plaintiffs waited some period of time because no motion was filed and then lost rights in another jurisdiction as a result, and that affected their election right, then I can see a prejudice that would develop. But we don't have any particular evidence of that in this record, correct?
As to what happened in other jurisdictions, no, Your Honor. We do not. We do have evidence in this record that the plaintiffs made agreements with DuPont to abate or stay trial on the merits without having any appreciation that DuPont would subsequently file a motion to dismiss on forum nonconvenience grounds as a last strategy after their special appearance motion was motions were overruled in the trial court. The Court of Appeals concluded that they were subject to general jurisdiction.
But what prejudice did you experience from that, separate and apart from any prejudice you experienced as a result of the special appearance being on file?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that in this context, in this timing, that the special appearance would have stayed trial on the merits in all of these matters. There are a number of various cases, and it's a little bit more complicated than an ordinary case where you're talking about, you know, one cause number and not a bunch of severed cases out. But aside from that, the parties believed that it was necessary to seek continuances from the trial judge on the basis that some pretrial matters need to be disposed of before it's sensible to proceed. Those pretrial matters were the special appearance motions in the context of waiting to see what happens in appellate courts or in the Supreme Court.
But that's isn't that required by the rules?
The statute and the statute and the rules, you know, address this at various times that may be pertinent.
To get along with Justice O'Neill, the answer to what prejudice, and you're talking about delays, but then you say the reason for the delay is trying to have the special appearances determined. So my question is, don't our rules require that if one of those is raised, it has to be determined before anything else?
For a trial on the merits.
And so
that's what the statute has required for some time. But we're talking about a longer time period than that. We're also talking about cases with different cause numbers that wouldn't have had special appearance motions involved in them.
But your clients are the plaintiffs. In those cases you're now talking about, can't they set up for trial and go ahead without regard to what DuPont?
Unfortunately, they agreed not to do so, believing that the special appearance motions, Orange County is a place where DuPont is the largest employer, that the special appearance motions would be overruled and we'd ultimately get down
well,
to the
does that make
starting
you,
line.
A participant in whatever delay?
Well, it's certainly an unwitting, a very unwitting and duped participant.
Well, but DuPont, I mean, your people were represented by counsel all the way through this.
That's right, Your Honor. But let me go, if I may, to talk about the statute and the reason why the statute is crafted the way it is. As this court decided and wrote in Owens Corning versus Carter, the first legislative response to this overall problem was an interesting one in the context of several different classes of cases. A forum nonconvenience statute was passed to retract or pull back the Alfaro case to a certain extent in 1993, but significant classes of cases were exempted from the operation of that statute. FELA cases, air transportation cases, as well as asbestos fiber cases. In effect, the 1993 legislation, which wasn't materially changed in 1995, told the non-resident plaintiffs that they were invited to come to Texas and to litigate these kinds of claims and that there wouldn't be any kind of forum non-convenience problem. The legislative history with respect to the 1997 amendments makes that perfectly plain. But by 1997, the legislature believed that much more had happened than was anticipated and that we'd had too many non-residents who were injured elsewhere accept the invitation to come and litigate in Texas courts. But they come to litigate in Texas courts from the early 90s, 1992, 1995, DuPont being joined in this case in 1996, and had litigated for some considerable period of time before 1997. So the legislature crafted a general forum nonconvenience statute that would be applicable more or less across the board, 71051, and as this court knows, modified 71.031 by adding a borrowing provision. And then to fix this problem of people who had been invited to come to Texas and file suits, we have 71052 enacted. And it's perfectly plain from the legislative history that there was more involved from a policy standpoint than just unclogging Texas dockets. That was certainly one clear aim of the statutory changes, but the other aim was to treat these people who had been invited to come here and who had litigated here for a considerable period of time fairly. Now, treating them fairly meant that they would be looked at in different ways depending upon the duration of time that their cases had been filed. I prepared a small handout, which I believe the clerk has provided to the court, which I believe accurately sets forth the different categories of cases dealt with in the statute, not just 71052, but 71051. Prior to August 1, 1995, no forum nonconvenience dismissal. This case, if we don't argue a relation back doctrine, fits within the second category, August 1, 1995 through January 1, 1997, because DuPont was joined in Orange County and in Jefferson County in 1996. September 10, 1996.
Are you not going to argue the relation back?
I'm going to leave that to the brief, Your Honor. I'm not going to argue that as my principal argument. I think I have better arguments, and my time is short. The second category is not like the first category or the third. The third category was the one dealt with principally by this court in Owens Corning versus Carter, people who file after January 1, 1997. In that third category, the court shall dismiss if defendant agrees that limitations are told discovery can be used in the new state. And as this court held, that may mean that the case can be refiled here, but in a great many circumstances, it means it needs to be refiled, elsewhere. In the middle category, in order to deal with these plaintiffs fairly, the statute provides a way for the cases to stay in Texas, and it also gives the plaintiffs an opportunity during an abatement period to look around elsewhere to see if there are any alternatives that might be satisfactory alternatives. Now, if a motion had been filed earlier, as early as could have been done by DuPont, which could have invoked 71.052 as early as May 29, 97, things would look considerably different in all likelihood to the plaintiffs from the standpoint of what kind of option they would be inclined to exercise. At any rate, in this case, the motion was denied.
The motion to dismiss
was denied.
I don't understand that. Can you explain that to me? Tell me how the May 29th, 97, you're saying that's the soonest they could have filed the motion?
Motion to dismiss for forum nonconvenience under 71052.
And are you
that's
saying
as
that would
could
then take us into this third category?
No, they could have filed it. 71052 became effective 5/29/97. Okay.
So what do you mean, Professor Dorsenio, by the statement that things would have looked a lot differently to the plaintiffs at that point in time on whether they would make an election?
Well, if a motion had been filed earlier, if the statute had been invoked at a time when it could have been invoked.
Okay, let's say it was filed the day the statute came into effect. I don't understand what then.
Then under those circumstances, the plaintiffs would have taken a look at the circumstances that were involved in filing the motion and had to make and would have made a determination as to how they would respond to it.
But they could still do that when the motion was filed.
They could still do that when the motion was filed, but they made an alternative response, which I think the statute also allows, saying that the defendant had waited too long to invoke the statutory mechanism and had on that basis.
But you just made the statement that if they had filed it as early as possible, somehow these columns would be affected. That's what I don't know.
No, the columns wouldn't be affected. What would have been that? Because the plaintiff still would have sued DuPont in the second category.
Right.
But DuPont would have filed the motion.
So how would the analysis be any different?
If DuPont filed the motion sooner, then the plaintiffs would be taking responsive action sooner. That would mean that they wouldn't have engaged in litigating in Texas.
So we're back to what we were talking about.
Yes, and they would have taken a look at the alternatives, the available alternatives, at an earlier point in time and been better able to deal with the overall problem of deciding which election they were going to make.
But again, we don't know that as a concrete, specific matter. That's just a vague.
We don't know that, Your Honor, as a concrete, specific matter because the trial judge denied DuPont relief because DuPont was too dilatory.
But we could know that. That's something that's determinable. We could look at specific plaintiffs and what they could have done in other jurisdictions.
Yes.
That's determinable, but it is not determined before us.
No, it is theoretically determinable. But it was not determined.
I mean, you could take a plaintiff and say, because they waited so long, they lost the right to file in another jurisdiction. Statute ran.
Well, let's assume hypothetically they could file in another jurisdiction against DuPont. In all likelihood, there would be complete diversity of citizenship and more than $75,000 in controversy. The case would then be removed. Upon removal, it would be transferred to the multi-district litigation proceeding in Philadelphia and probably would never be heard from again, especially in the context of claims for punitive damages, which are the claims under Alabama law that the plaintiffs can make under the Alabama wrongful death statute, where you only get punitive damages.
But a question. If the date that you suggest DuPont should have filed was May, the earliest date was May of 97, had the trial court determined their special appearances by that time?
I don't know if the trial judge had determined the special appearances at that time, but the special appearances were determined long in the trial court, long before. I think that they may have been determined by that time, but I don't have a specific recollection.
So
it was long before.
They would not have waived their special.
There's no inconsistency, no waiver here. This is just a choice to wait until one thing is finished before doing something else. Now let me talk about the statutory language and the timing. The legislature intended to unclog the system for sure, and 71052 is, you know, a work in progress in many respects. The first Senate Bill 220 talked about abating these cases, all of them, except in certain circumstances where somebody had been diagnosed with mesothelioma, for 1 year, giving the plaintiffs a chance to go elsewhere, saying that the defendant needs to make a motion sometime in 1998, a motion to dismiss by sometime in 1998. That dropped out of the picture when the statutory scheme changed to dividing cases up into pre-August 1, 1985, and then the middle category, and then the third category. But clearly the legislature contemplated that these motions would be made early. We'd have a 180-day abatement period, possibly, while the plaintiff looked around, and then the case would be gone if it left, and then we'd have the opportunity for the plaintiff to elect to abide by the Texas cap and have the matter stay here. All of that was delayed in the first place by the action of DuPont. Because the trial judge ruled in the plaintiff's favor, because of the dilatory character of DuPont's activity, in all likelihood, from the standpoint of what the record shows happened at the hearing, you know, all of this becomes put off, truncated, delayed. Since I see I have 5 minutes, I want to talk about adequacy of remedy, which I just do think fits into this, you know, quite well. But maybe before I do that, let me just say this. The statute right now, 71052, doesn't say when the defendant needs to move to dismiss. It doesn't say when the plaintiff needs to make the stipulations. It seems to have been assumed by the legislature that this would all kind of have happened pretty soon after the statute was passed. But it didn't in this case. The normal rule for dilatory pleas, whether it's called a plea in abatement or any other kind of dilatory plea in this jurisdiction, although we don't have a procedural rule that says anything about due order or timing, is that they will be asserted promptly. There are several cases in our jurisprudence where that didn't happen, and the courts of appeals have concluded that there would be no ability to litigate the plea in abatement because too much time had passed. Just two examples that aren't yet cited in our briefing is one involving Charles Ben Howe and Justice Mawsey, 899 Southwest 2nd. Another one is out of the First Court, the Gibraltar Blue Bonnet Farms versus Gibraltar Savings. Both of those cases say it is Texas law that you need to not sit on your rights, but you need to proceed to litigate dilatory pleas promptly. All right, now let me talk about the adequacy of the remedy. This court has grappled with this issue and decided several cases over the years that have said even if it is a plea to the jurisdiction, the remedy of appeal, the remedy at law is adequate. It doesn't matter that the defendant has to sit through a longer trial. But there's even a better argument in this case from the standpoint of the plaintiffs is that the harm that the legislature identified with respect to these middle category cases is not that they would proceed in Texas, okay, but that they would proceed in Texas without a cap, without the Texas cap. And that harm, if any there be, can clearly be remedied on appeal before judgment or at any time. And I'll say one last point, if I may.
Hey, Willie, somebody asked the question.
Go ahead.
If it comes to it, the plaintiffs will elect the Texas cap. The Alabama plaintiffs will elect the Texas cap, if it comes to it, if they must do so.
Well, they can no longer do that, can they?
The statute has no time requirements on any of this. The argument that DuPont makes that somehow conditional jurisdiction vanishes, never to be resurrected, has no foundation in the statute or anywhere else that I can discern.
Can we take your statement as a Rule 11 agreement?
Your Honor, you can take my statement as a representation.
Better still, can DuPont take it as a Rule 11 agreement on behalf of the 8,000 plaintiffs you represent?
No, Your Honor, it may well be that some of the plaintiffs won't want to do this.
But then maybe you better withdraw that statement.
Oh, I don't want to withdraw it, Your Honor. The plaintiffs will. The plaintiffs, considerable number of them will, but they will put some of them at more risk than others. And they may decide not to do it.
You mentioned that the harm that the statute was trying to avoid was going forward without the statutory cap on punitive damages. Is there any reference in the legislative history to that?
Well, I think there is. There's considerable talk about that, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
May it please the Court.
Do you agree with Professor Dersania that if you get to wait to file your motion to dismiss, that the plaintiffs can wait then to file their election?
No, Your Honor, I do not. And I also,
why not?
I believe the statute, in not the clearest words, but I believe the statute itself provides for the sequencing that DuPont contemplates. In subpart C of the statute states, the court, on the motion of a defendant, shall dismiss each claim against the defendant that meets the statute. Then it says, unless the plaintiff files a written statement electing to abate the plaintiff's claim.
Right, but there's no time limit.
Well,
if there's no time limit for you, there's no time limit for them. Would you
but in the next,
to this argument?
In the continuing on there, for a period of 180 days from the date the court disposes of the defendant's motion, I believe that inartfully that states that the plaintiff has to elect before there's a disposition of the motion.
But there's an or that comes after that. The 180 days is only in subpart one.
Your Honor, I still think that the statute, if you read it reasonably, has only one conclusion, and that is the plaintiff has to elect before the trial court decides what to do with the claims against the defendant. That's the only sensible reading of the statute.
I thought the plaintiff got 180 days after the court decides what it's going to do.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that that's the case, because then, first of all, the trial court wouldn't know whether it was required to dismiss
it. Well, let me ask you this. So the trial court, here's a motion to dismiss, and the trial court comes up, and they're required to say, well, give us 180 days to look around before they know whether the trial court thinks the motion's good?
Your Honor, I believe they're required. That's their burden in responding
so
to the motion.
They have to kind of guess what the judge is going to do and ask for. Why couldn't the judge say, I think their motion's good, and say, okay, give us 180 days to go look around and see what we're going to do? Why couldn't the
Your Honor, there's really no guesswork as to what the trial court, if it's a trial court that follows the law, what it will do. If the four elements are proven in this case, there has to be a dismissal unless the plaintiff elects. The plaintiff's not put to a quandary at all. The plaintiff's choice is either elect to abate the case and go refile somewhere else, or accept the Texas punitive damage caps, or in this case, do nothing and allow its case to be dismissed in Texas and then just...
But this case hasn't been dismissed yet, so why can't they do it now?
This case should have been dismissed.
No, it hasn't been.
Your Honor...
And I don't see any. Your opponents raised an argument that if we're going to let you all have as much time as you want, then you say there's no time requirement in the statute, that we see no time requirement for plaintiff to make an election before dismissal to avoid this. I'm interested in what your response to that is.
Well, I suppose that would be circuitous. That contemplates that the trial court would be required if the trial court follows what the statute says. At the time the trial court sits down to rule in this case or in any other case like it where the plaintiff chooses not to elect in response to the motion, the trial court at that stage is required to dismiss the cause. Then, if the trial court follows the statute, the plaintiff is not going to have a claim left on which to elect.
You say it's an abuse of discretion. So you file a motion that alleges the four elements. Now, is the court required to dismiss at that point? You file a motion to dismiss, you allege the four elements, is the trial court required to dismiss at that point?
If we prove the four elements of hearing, Your Honor,
So you file a motion, now there's a hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
And on the hearing, you provide evidence on the four elements. Some of it's disputed, some of it's not disputed. At that point, is the plaintiff permitted to file the election, or is it too late to file the election at the conclusion of the evidence of the defendant's case?
I have no problem with the plaintiff filing a motion at that juncture before there is a ruling on the motion. But when the motion is ruled on, the plaintiff has no longer any, there is no longer a claim, and there is no longer anything with which to exercise the election right.
So the trial court makes an oral ruling from the bench, that's when it's too late to file the election.
Well, Your Honor, every position has its breaking point. I'm not sure that I will parse hairs between oral rulings and written orders, but the point is, in this case, there was clearly a definitive ruling by the trial court, I believe orally and then in writing, and the plaintiffs, if they wished to elect, they were at their own peril if they didn't elect before the trial court ruled.
Why would they have to elect if the trial court said, I'm not going to dismiss? I mean, you're saying that, if orally from the bench the judge says, I'm not dismissing, then the election would never be in play. If you're saying that the trial judge can sit there and say, plaintiffs, I'm going to dismiss, I think I'm going to grant this motion, I'm going to dismiss, and then the plaintiff jumps up and says, Judge, I make an election, then it would be okay. Well, we've never gotten to that point in this case.
Well, another problem I have with that position, Your Honor, is that would presume that a plaintiff could go ahead and try the case on its merits to a conclusion and then see what result that they liked, and then decide, well, I think I'll go ahead and abate the case since I didn't win in Texas and file somewhere else. I just think it's an unworkable position. It's not something that's provided for in the statute. And this statute, by the way, does not contain any exception for plaintiffs that Mr. Dorsanio purports. The statute is plain and clear on its merits.
Let me ask you this. So far, the trial court didn't dismiss, the Court of Appeals didn't dismiss, and we've made no representation one way or the other about our decision. Can Mr. Dorsanio go out now and file an election to take the damage caps? And if he does so, what do we do?
Your Honor, my initial response would still be as consistently with what I've stated before, and that's at the time the trial court rules, the period for making an election is over. This court's choice.
Even if the trial court denies it.
Well, Your Honor, this court is being asked to determine whether this trial court, when it ruled in 1999, or 2000, ruled consonant with this statute, and if it did or didn't do that, whether this court should grant mandamus. We're not. The question is not what a trial court.
Well, I guess I'm kind of troubled. Assume everything you say is correct. But the trial court never indicated any intention about granting the dismissal. At what point would the plaintiff have known that they must exercise the election? Going back, because you file a dismissal, are they required to do the election not knowing what the trial court would do? Or after they hear your evidence, are they then required to evaluate themselves on whether it's good or not and then file the election? Or what really happens is the trial court says, I'm fixing to dismiss, then they have to either elect or they suffer the dismissal. Isn't that how the statute works? The trial court says, look, it's good, I'm going to dismiss, then they've got to exercise their election at that point. And then that really how the statute
Your Honor, I respectfully have to disagree. I believe the statute is contemplated to work such that the defendant files the motion, the defendant goes on record as invoking the power of the statute, and then the plaintiff, based on that and that alone, is put to the choice. Based on all the circumstances of the litigation, do I want to elect to abate this case, or do I want to elect to embrace the punitive damage caps, or do I just want to waive that, forego that, refuse that, and take my chances? And the plaintiff is put to that election at the outset based on the filing of the motion, not based on hypothesizing what the trial court will rule or is this a trial court that obeys the law or doesn't obey the law. The law was clear, and these plaintiffs chose not to exercise the rights.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument from the first clause of the Section 3 of 6.
All rise.